So without any further ado, it is my pleasure to introduce Gil Bailey. Gil took a law degree from the University of Tennessee in 1967, but has devoted his life to exploring, teaching, and lecturing on the Western literary and religious tradition. He's the founder and president of the Cornerstone Forum, a founding member of the Colloquium on Violence and Religion, a member of the Fellowship of Catholic Scholars, and a member of the College of Fellows of the Dominican School of Philosophy and Theology. For more than two decades, Gil worked with his friend and informal teacher, the Stanford professor and noted cultural theorist, René Girard, whose work he presented to a non-academic readership in his 1995 book, Violence Unveiled, Humanity at the Crossroads. In arguing for a restoration of a robust Alpha and Omega Christology in his 2016 book, God's Gamble, The Gravitational Power of Crucified Love, he brought Girard's important anthropological contribution to human self-understanding and to dialogue with the thought of the theological tradition exemplified by Joseph Ratzinger, Henri de Lubac, and Hans-Urs von Balthasar, with special attention given to the latter's Holy Saturday theology. In his latest book, which we're going to discuss today, The Apocalypse of the Sovereign Self, Recovering the Christian Mystery of Personhood, he addresses the prevalent spiritual pathologies that have arisen as Western culture surrendered its Christian patrimony. Welcome to the show, Gil. It's great to have you with us.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I look forward to our conversation.
Yeah, and we also have on the line one of your newest members of the Cornerstone Forum, Bill Wynn. Welcome to the show, Bill.
Hey, Gil and Ken. How are you?
Good.
Hi, Bill.
So, Gil, I was planning on getting through the entire book, and the weekend kind of blew up on me. So, but I do know we swapped a couple emails in preparation for the show, and I think before we get started, maybe a little overview is in order for those that may not be familiar with your body of work or that of René Girard.
Well, it's very difficult to summarize quickly, but to speak just of what this book is trying to do, I begin by realizing that we are in a civilizational crisis. And at the heart of that crisis is the attenuation or the lack, our civilization is founded on the Judeo-Christian tradition. And when that foundation begins to be dissolved, as it has been over the last 200 years, and very precipitously over the last 75, it has huge, not only cultural and civilizational consequences, but also consequences on personal integrity and coherence, because each of us is coherent to ourselves because we live within that Christian understanding of reality. Even if we don't believe in Christ, or we would never cross the threshold of a church, the culture itself has an understanding of what it means to be a person. And that's quite distinct from what people now think of as the self. The self the word person is a Christian term. The only reason that it's serious is because the early Christians used that term uniquely for speaking of the three persons in the Trinity. And so what we're losing is a robust and fruitful understanding of the mystery of personhood. And what we're getting instead is this emaciated, shrunken idea of the self. And I can give, to make it a little bit less wordy, I can compare two quotations that give some hint of what I'm talking about here. The first is probably familiar to your listeners. And it's the infamous Anthony Kennedy decision in the 1992 Supreme Court Casey decision, in which he said, quote, which was affirming the right to abortion, Justice Kennedy said, quote, "At the heart of liberty is the right to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning, of the universe, and of the mystery of human life." Now, for me, in our world today, that seems quite nice. But what it really, there's a word for that, and the word is nihilism. There's no, it renounces any idea of truth and reality and places all the emphasis on personal whim. In other words, the truth is what I decide the truth is. There's your truth and my truth, but there is no truth with a capital T. And this is the predicament we're in. We live in a world that is increasingly nihilistic. The word nihilism means nothing, of course, and it means quite literally nothing. It means that there are no truths. There is only your truth and my truth. Well, one of the first people in the New Testament to make this clear to us was Pilate, when he said mockingly to Jesus, "What is truth?" in a mocking way. That's so much of our culture today is asking Pilate's question with emphasis and to some extent with aggressively. What is truth? Well, that's Pilate's intellectual nihilism. And in short order, it gave rise to a cultural nihilism, which was a crowd shouting, "Crucify him." So there's a link between our losing of the Christian inheritance that teaches us about truth and reality, and our tendency to try to summon up something that will be as engaging as truth is. And what's very engaging is the idea of violence. It appeals to someone who is stranded in a world without any grasp on truth. So I don't want to go on too long, but I will quote one quote. You mentioned Romano Guardini, who's one of the sources, my source, is a great German Catholic theologian. And he says in one of his most important books, he says the following: "The knowledge of what it means to be a person is inextricably bound up with the faith of Christianity. An affirmation and cultivation of the personal can endure for a time, perhaps, after faith has been extinguished, but gradually they too will be lost," which is precisely what has happened. We have individual isolated selves, selves, that think that their only relationship to truth is what they decide is true. And great catastrophes are being prepared for us because of that confusion. Now, my book is an attempt to give a background, a little trace of how we came to this place. And it's written, your listeners might think it's written for the academics. It's not at all. I'm not an academic. It's written for the average person. But it's a way of, in an accessible way, I hope it's accessible, I think it is, an accessible way to show how we got to this predicament. That's the first half of the book. And the second half of the book is how we can reclaim the mystery of the person as understood by Christianity. So that's the broadest possible synopsis, but I'll be happy to explore elements of it if you like.
No, sure. And, you know, I was introduced to you and Rene Girard and this line of thinking a while back by our other guest, Bill Wynn, today. And when I read your works and listen to some of the podcasts and talks that you've given, it all makes perfect sense when we look at what's happening in the world today and the loss of personhood and this idea of self. And I've been saying for years, without being aware of your body of work, that Augustine came to the Catholic Church because he was searching for the truth. And so many of the early saints that converted converted to Christianity were searching for the truth. And in this current day and age, nobody seems to be searching for the truth. Like you said, everybody has their own truth, and I guess in some ways, as long as my truth doesn't conflict with your truth, we'll get along. But when our truths do conflict, we see what's going on in this crazy world of ours today. And so when I read your work, it all makes perfect sense as to what we're seeing unfold, but it's a different light that nobody else is talking about.
Well, that's true. I mean, my friend and teacher, Rene Girard, was really brilliant. Bishop Barron says he thinks he'll be one of the church fathers one day. Well, Rene would probably be embarrassed to hear that, but Rene died in 2015, but he was an extraordinary human being with tremendous insight into the mystery of our existence. And
along that lines, interesting. So Father McKay, who was just on the previous hour, has this saying, "Odd or God." And one of the things that jumped out at me is the radio station we're talking to you on is based in Bryn Mawr, Pennsylvania. So I know my understanding of the conversion of Rene Girard is it happened on a train from where he was teaching at Bryn Mawr going back to where he teaches John Hopkins in Baltimore. Is that correct?
That's very nice. Yes, exactly. But that was the beginning of a spiritual journey. That was not the end of it. It was the beginning of it, and I had the privilege of knowing Rene in the last 20 years of his life. Of course, a conversion is always an ongoing process. In the last 20 years of his life, he exuded it in a way that was quite inspiring. Go ahead.
No, that's okay. I was just going to say, so in the as you mentioned in the first half of the book, you kind of give a summary of your thoughts around this. And one of the things that struck me is how much we pride ourselves on individual rights. And I actually had a conversation with somebody to the effect that prior to Christ, we didn't have individual rights. In cultures prior to that, it would be a king or some predominant leader, and everybody other than he and maybe a small cohort would be would just serve him. And they didn't have those individual rights. And somebody got into an argument with me and said there's all kinds of examples, but couldn't come up with one. And
yeah.
And now we see that those individual rights that have come about in the last few hundred years especially, that it's kind of led us down this path to where the rights have become more important than the person and actually turned in on us, if I'm not mistaken.
Absolutely. Those rights are rooted in reality. The reality is that each of us has a religious line. Let me finish one thought before I get into another. Those rights have to do with the dignity of the human person. It's not a matter of you get to do whatever you want, because that ignores the dignity of the human person. If I say to someone, you can do anything you want, you can sit around and watch pornography all day because that's your choice. That, if that's a right, it is not a right that has anything to do with our tradition. Our right is to the, our human dignity, individual human dignity. And if we make choices that destroy, that rob ourselves of that dignity, we are not exercising our rights in any serious way. We're simply betraying the, you know, the person we were meant to be. So, yeah, the idea of rights has really gone sideways. We have the rights come to us from God. Thank goodness our founding documents in this country make that clear. But most people today don't, many people today don't appreciate that. So we have rights, but we only have rights because we need them in order to live a morally principled life. And it's not just a right to believe anything that comes along. As you know, I mean, today people think they can wake up one morning and think a man can think he's a woman and vice versa and so on. It's a madness. And it's the rights discourse gone crazy. Or what G.K. Chesterton said, it's a Christian principle gone mad. So what I'm trying to do in this book is to show how we get back to an understanding of the person that inspires us to live lives of personal freedom, but not personal license. Personal freedom is the freedom to live according to our making, our constitution. So this is immensely important, and the church is the Western cultures, and I speak broadly here of the church. Of course, I'm a Roman Catholic. And I think it has a unique place in our cultural history, obviously. But the church, broadly speaking, where it's remained faithful, it continues to be a source of truth about who we are and why we're here. And the idea that we're here for whatever I want to decide I want to be here for is a recipe for unhappiness. God is asking something of each of us. And, you know, once we realize that God is asking each of us for something that's unique to us, that if we don't do it, you know, it's our job. We're each of us has a vocation. And prayer and the sacraments and the mystery of our faith help us to understand. It may be a big vocation, and most likely it's a small vocation, but it's one that's indispensable. So a small vocation that's indispensable is more valuable than a big vocation. It wouldn't be a vocation in that case, of course, but a big vocation that's completely arbitrary. We all have a small vocation to behave ourselves in certain ways and to proclaim the truth in certain ways that will be fruitful for the people with whom we live in our culture. So this book is an attempt to. The first half is an attempt to give the average reader a fairly entertaining idea of how this madness came upon us. And the transition is the prodigal son story. And the second half of the book is about how we recover the mystery of personhood. And, so far readers have been, it's been well reviewed, so I'm hoping that your listeners will, those of your listeners who might want to look at it, I think they might find it interesting.
I know that I have, Gil, and again, if you joined us late, our guest today is Gil Bailey, and the book we're talking about is entitled The Apocalypse of the Sovereign Self, with the subtitle Recovering the Christian Mystery of Personhood. It's published by Angelico Press. Best ways to get the book, Gil, other than the big online stores?
Yeah, well, that's pretty much it.
Okay.
I think at the Cornerstone Forum, I'm pretty sure it's on the Cornerstone Forum. That's cornerstoneforum.org. I think we have some books on the Cornerstone Forum, but Amazon and Barnes & Noble have it for sure.
Very good. I've had the pleasure of spending some time with Bill today, and I know Bill had some questions that he had for you. Bill?
Yeah, sure. So, Gil, one of the stories that really jumped out at me that I really thought got across the idea of how behavior is modeled is the Buddy Holly, Bob Dylan story. So I don't know if maybe you can go into that a little bit.
Well, some of my readers, some of my more devout readers will be getting heartburn when I start with Bob Dylan, but he received a Nobel Prize for Literature, and in his acceptance speech, he talks about it, a moment of conversion, and it was a moment when he was in the presence of Buddy Holly, very, very standing very close to Buddy Holly, and it's a conversion story. And what I've used it to show is there are two things about us human beings. There are two huge anthropological realities. The first is the most important thing about us is not the opposable thumb or the invention of the wheel. The most important thing about us is religious longing. We, unlike all the rest of the creatures in our world, we have religious longing. And it's all but inextinguishable. So it will come out. And the thing you have to know about religious longing, there are a couple of things. One is, it's always mediated. And by that I mean, there will always be a mediator who awakens that longing and directs it to its appropriate, or directs it in some way. On the cover of the book is a picture that came out of the Catholic Catechism, and it's a depiction of precisely what I'm talking about here. It's awakened by somebody who's pointing to Christ, who's pointing to the Father. In other words, so this religious longing is awakened and oriented or pointed towards something. Now, if we have no religious opportunities in our lives, the religious longing doesn't go away. It just invests itself in idols. That is to say, it idolizes some person who is never fully worthy of that devotion, or some more likely now, it's devoted to a political or ideological causes that unleash violence. So why are people so prone to collective violence we've always been prone to collective violence, we humans. But we're prone to it because when we're caught up in a crowd that's tearing down a statue because we think whoever the statue represents was a racist or something, that passion of tearing down is a religious, if it's a religious experience with a small r and in quotation mark. It's taking that religious longing and putting it in exactly the wrong place, and it turns into violence. And that's the world we live in today. And recovering a Christian understanding of a person helps us understand what it means to be a person by showing us a person who is the person par excellence, the person who happens to be himself the second person of the divine Trinity. He exists to show us what it means to be a person. He does so by pointing us to the Father with the help of the Holy Spirit. All of this has to do with recovering the mystery of our existence.
Yeah, and as you're speaking, Gil, I'm thinking, you know, the world that I'm involved in, which is a lot of folks that are involved with addiction and those types of things, and we often use the line, and it's a G.K. Chesterton line as well, that every man that knocks on the door of a brothel is looking for God.
That's fantastic.
And we're all wired for ecstasy, and I think when we look at our brothers and sisters and realize, like you said, you don't have a choice on whether or not you have this religious longing. It's the way God wired us. And it can help explain why people behave the way that they do. And when in your body of work, when you see how that translates, not just like in my world into addiction, but how it translates into all the violence that we continue to see. It's been around for a while, probably spiked with the activities in 2020 and 2021, but continues to this day. You know, with the murder rates that we see and people just annihilating each other, trying to satisfy this longing that they have that nobody will explain to them properly.
Exactly right. Well, you're doing God's work.
Well, I do understand
sure.
a little.
It's like peeling an onion. Yeah. You get deeper and deeper each time, right?
Yeah.
Another chapter, Gil, that jumped out to me that really struck me was chapter 17. You talked about hysteria, the illness of our age. Some fascinating insights in terms of how like Freud and them got into that diagnosis and then how it evolved. I don't know if you can talk to that a little bit.
Well, it's quite complicated, and it fits in the sequence of the chapters before and after. All of the things that I look at in these chapters have to do with the fact of the religious longing that is mediated, and if it's improperly mediated, which it almost always is, unless it's happening within a religious and especially a Christian context, we fall under the spell of another. We become, we find ourselves idolizing the other. And people sense that to fall under the spell of another is very dangerous. And so they try to fend off the other. In other words, if I'm in the presence of this really magnetic personality and I have a precarious hold on my own identity, I feel like if I get too close to this person, I'm just going to be completely absorbed, and I'll give my life to this person the way a faithful person would give his life to Christ. And there's a reaction to that. The two reactions there that are healthy, but they're part of a pathology as well. One is to start behaving in an extroverted way, start trying to outperform the model so that you don't become, you know, absorbed in the model. You retain your own personal integrity. So you begin to compete with the model in terms of how autonomous you are with respect to the model. And the other is you just clam up to prevent the model from having any more influence. Your face goes blank. Your body becomes immovable. These are the two classic versions of hysteria. And they have to do with the collapse of the understanding of a person. But if Freud misunderstood that, he didn't realize that the problems he was analyzing were historical. He thought he was going, you know, all the way back to Greek times, that hysteria was the most ancient of diseases and so on. It's found elsewhere in history, but it wasn't. It was because of the crisis that was overtaking the Western world. You had people who were so precarious, so ontologically, I'm sorry to say that word, but so personally precarious because they had no ballast. They were not rooted in church, in Christ, in God, in prayer, all those things that root us. Because they had lost those roots, they were like chaff blowing in the wind, and they would try to retain whatever little amount of coherence they still had by either acting, you know, exorbitantly to try to show, you know, prove that they're their own person, or by shutting down and becoming, protecting themselves. So I look at Freud and Nietzsche and some other people who actually, if we understand them correctly, they point us in the right direction. Both Freud and Nietzsche made terrible mistakes, but their mistakes, if we analyze them carefully, are tremendously helpful in understanding the situation we're in. They had a kind of diagnostic genius, but they misunderstood, especially Freud. Nietzsche understood and simply chose Dionysus rather than Christ. That was his thing. But I don't want to get too complicated. It sounds like this. Believe me, I want your audience to realize I'm not an academic. So I write term, for the average reader. And when I talk about these things.
The term that jumps to mind, the way you describe that, is the concept of terminal uniqueness. Right? That people, like the way you describe culture, it's almost, from the body of work that I've read, you get this concept of a sacrificial crisis. That things have become our violence or our arguments are not caused by differences. They're caused by the fact that we've become so similar, but we need distinction. And I think this becomes this root of this theory that something about me has to be special. And in a world when it's not, we seek it in any way we can, even in being the victim.
Yeah, absolutely.
That makes sense?
Yeah.
The other concept that's important probably for this audience to understand your body of work and Gerard's and this whole concept of Catholic cultural anthropology is that we are actors in the drama of history. I've listened to a lot of your number of your podcasts at the Cornerstone Forum, and I think in a lot of those podcasts, you bring this out very, very well in terms of your analysis of the prophets and the Old Testament and stuff like that. So just talk real quickly about the drama of history.
Well, here's the way to think about it, because I have Apocalypse in the title of my book. So, Hans von Balthasar, in my opinion, the greatest theologian of the 20th century, he said something that is unbelievably powerful. He said, history after Christ consists of the mutual intensification of the yes and the no to Christ. Now, say to that, history after Christ consists of the mutual intensification of the yes and the no to Christ. The yes intensifies and the no intensifies. Now, and I quote Dylan, when Dylan came to a Christian conversion, he heard the song, and the refrain of the song is, you have to serve, the title of the song, you have to serve somebody. And the refrain of the song is, it may be the devil or it may be his Lord, but you have to serve somebody. So both von Balthasar, the great theologian, and Dylan, the popular music man, they both only mention two options, the devil or the Lord, the yes and the no to Christ. Now, how do we understand that? Here's how this is not in the book. But it comes to me. G.K. Chesterton, I'm going to paraphrase something he said. It's absolutely faithful to what he said, but I'm going to slightly paraphrase. He said, if everybody lived to be 1,000 years old, they would all die Catholic. And that's so characteristic of Chesterton. Well, let's ask ourselves, why is that? And I would say that if we all lived that long, we would have enough experience to look back on so that we would realize that all the little decisions we made along the way were, in one way or another, a yes and a no Christ, or the decision between the choice between the devil and the Lord. So we are living in a world where, in some way, our lives are too short for us to see the drama in which we're living, which is why we absolutely need a religious tradition that reminds us of the nature of the drama in which we are playing a small part. And that's what the church does. She reminds us that there is a bigger drama of salvation underway, and we are all playing a part in it. And the more we realize that, the more we can take full responsibility for the little part we had to play, and almost all of us have very little parts to play in it, but they're essential. So if my part is raising some children, or if my part is in teaching a high school class on physics, or if my part is being a missionary in Africa, whatever it is, what is the part we're playing in the drama of salvation? And
hey, my initial introduction to Gerard came out of a video someone sent me in 2016, where Gerard describes Peter's denial, and basically says humanity is either Peter where they're seeking mercy, or they're Judas, where they're judging themselves unworthy.
Renee brought to the biblical studies a tremendous insight because of his anthropological research. He saw what was so dramatically different about the Bible. I first met him when he came to my office to talk to some biblical scholars about the implication of his work for biblical studies. And he was totally amazed them, because he was talking from the point of view of his anthropological studies, and he was seeing things about our tradition that were completely compatible with everything that we know, but quite new and exciting.
Yeah, to people listening here, so your website, the cornerstoneforum.org, under your podcast tab, have two podcasts, one Keeping Faith and Breaking Ground, and the other Violence and the Sacred. So Keeping Faith and Breaking Ground are your presentations, and Violence and Sacred are your or Gerard's presentations, correct?
You know, I think so. I have very little to do with the website. So
if anyone's interested in these topics, you can get more information at thecornerstoneforum.org in those podcasts. And like Gil said, Gil's analysis of the Bible and Violence Unveiled is very good, as well as Gerard's stuff under Violence and the Sacred. It's very much worth listening to.
Well, you're welcome to say so.
And as a newcomer to this, Gil, in some ways, it's like, can it really be this simple, that it's a yes or no to Christ, or it's a choice for Christ or the devil? Because we as human beings, we complicate everything, and there's always a but or an and or... Bill used the word earlier, or terminal uniqueness, that we think that we have to come up with our own philosophy or our own paths, and it really is pretty simple when you get right down to it.
Well, it's difficult because we're so ornery, as we used to say in Tennessee. we kind of want to do it ourselves. And it does require our personal commitment. It's not just a question of going along with something. But this is why I think. By the way, I'm a very bad Catholic, even though I go to Mass and say the Rosary every day. I don't regard myself as a paragon of Catholic virtue. But we have to realize that we're fallen creatures. We're infected by a selfishness and a pride, most of all pride. To follow Christ, you have to put your pride away. You see, it's an ongoing challenge for all of us to be Christians in the full sense, and we all fail every single day. But for me, it's the call, and Christ has given us the Holy Spirit, and now I'm talking Catholicism and not just about my book, but Christ has given us the Holy Spirit, and the Holy Spirit is a still small voice, and you can't hear a still small voice until you make space for that in prayer and devotion and so on. So every one of us is being called. And if we can hear, and probably we're being called to what's right in front of us. if you wake up one day and you think, oh, I'm being called to do something on the other side of the planet, or I'm being called to do something that, you know, some grand thing, well, you might rethink it, because it's very likely that you're being called to do something quite close to home and quite humble. But if you do it, by the way, I don't know, if you turn to the back of the book, I end the book with this wonderful Richard Wilbur poem about a nun. You'll have to read it. It's worth the price of the book just to read the few lines of that poem. But it has to do with simply knowing what you're called to, however humble it is, and doing it day in and day out for the love of God. So I try not to be a salesman about my book, but I'm going to be quite evangelical now, and I'm going to say, all your listeners should go out and get that book. There are other poems in the book that are well worth reading. But if you go out and get that book and read the last poem on the last page, you'll be glad you bought the book.
And again, if you're going to go out and buy it, the book's written by our guest, Gil Bailey, and the title of the book is The Apocalypse of the Sovereign Self, Recovering the Christian Mystery of Personhood. Bill, you were trying to get a question in?
I think Gil kind of answered my question as I continue to listen instead of interrupting.
Yeah, no problem. I'm sorry. But
did I interrupt you?
No, that's okay.
But what's interesting is, and you can see this if you look at the frustration that people express, that they haven't sought out what their vocation is. You talk about, you know, models and those that mediate, and people latch on to them but may not look at it in terms of a vocation and what they're really being called to do. Something may appeal to them about the mediator or the model, but if it's not what God's calling them to be, they're still going to end up frustrated and unfulfilled in that longing that we've been talking about.
Yeah. You know, the other thing is, to go back to another of Von Balthasar's tremendous insights, that of the theodrama. Christianity sets in motion a theodrama, and each of us is called to play a part in that theodrama. So it's not simply who, it's the role we have to play is not simply discernible by looking inside. It's also by seeing the drama in which we're surrounded and what our role would be in that theodrama. And it's the outworking of the revelation of Christ. That's the drama. But we play a role in it, which means that we are actors in the drama. And most people think to be an actor is a phony thing. Well, it certainly can be, and there are plenty of examples of phony actors. But to be an actor in the real drama means that you may only, perhaps you're called simply to comport yourself in such a way as to be the occasion for someone looking on to ask himself, I wonder what it is that makes him so happy. You know, St. Peter said, be prepared to give the reason for the hope you have in you. But you don't have to give a reason for the hope. You can exhibit it in some way without being an exhibitionist. You exhibit it in a very natural way by being kind and generous and friendly and helpful and courteous and all those things And increasingly in our world where people are going crazy, someone who's kind and generous and so on stands out. You're not someone that hits the horn the minute the car in front of you doesn't move along when the light turns green, and so on. You behave in a way that makes the world a better place. And if people notice that, all the better. Because it's not because you're performing for an audience, but you are representing something beyond yourself. You're here to represent, which is what representing means. You're here to represent Christ to the world. So if people look on you and they say, well, that's a person who's always cheerful and faithful and filled with hope, I wonder where in the world he gets that. That's part of the theodrama. I used to quote very often the Islamic poet Rumi, who said, be like one who, when he walks into the room, luck shifts to the one who needs it, which is a wonderful observation. Be like one who, when he walks into the room, luck shifts to the one who needs it. But I think Peter's command to us is more specific. Be prepared to give the reason for the hope, to exhibit to the world in some way your hopefulness, and to let the world know in whatever way is appropriate to the circumstance and to your situation, and to let any others who might be there to learn the lesson, let them know where you got that hope. So Christian faith is it's to take part in a drama. So all of us are living in this huge theodrama, and our part as Christians is to convey to our fellows the gift of faith that we have, and if they're so disposed to invite them to explore that gift.
One of the things, your use of the word represent, one of the things that I love in your writing and in Rene Girard's is getting to the original meaning of words and getting down to what they really mean. And two of the most fascinating words to get to the original meaning of are Satan and the Paraclete.
Oh, of course, yeah.
So maybe our audience would find that interesting if you could describe the origin of those two words.
Well, that for me it is best. Satan is the one who divides and points the finger and causes confusion and animosity and rancor. And the Paraclete is the one who gathers together and gives a sense of unity and fellowship.
Is it correct to say they were actually the roles in an ancient trial, that the Satan was the one who brought the charges and the Paraclete was your defender?
Yeah, that's Rene's shorthand for it. The Paraclete is the one who, ask yourself, at crucifixion, the centurion, Jesus dies on the cross, the centurion says, he was an innocent man. And I think I deal with this in the book. He was an innocent. How did he know and why did he care? This was a guy who was paid to torture and execute people that were, he was told deserved it. And he was not he was the last person in the world you'd think would suddenly find the victim more interesting than everything else. Surely he was an innocent man. Something happened at that moment. Something very powerful opened that man's eyes. And that's what Christianity has been doing for 2,000 years. Coming, breaking in on us and opening our eyes and making us realize, what are we doing? What have we been doing? We've been sleepwalking and going along and not fully participating in the mystery of our redemption. So I think that the centurion, the conversion of the centurion, is a it foretells the effect of Christianity on human culture. When Caiaphas said it's better that one should die than the whole nation should be destroyed, he would have gotten the Nobel Peace Prize for that because of the economy. You know, if you can solve all that rancor with the death of one person and save thousands of people from killing each other, you say that's a pretty good deal. But first of all, you have to be willing to let one person take the rap for everybody else's sinfulness. And as soon as you're not willing to do that, you're very close to stumbling into Christianity.
When I try to get folks engaged in this line of thought, the way I put it to them is, you cannot possibly understand what the gospel says until you understand what the gospel is. So the gospel is the true story that what actually happened in relation to a state-sponsored execution.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, that's right.
So,
it's that. It's ever so much more than that in a way, but it's that. Just to begin with, for sure. And
just a time check here. So we got about 2 minutes before we need to wrap up. And Gil, I wanted to give you a chance to say anything that needs to be said that we haven't said yet before we have to let you go. Again, our guest today is Gil Bailey, and the book we're talking about is The Apocalypse of the Sovereign Self, Recovering the Christian Mystery of Personhood. Just got about 2 minutes, Gil.
Well, you know, I don't really. I've gone off in all directions, and because I was quite excited by your questions and your comments, so I sort of went off in all directions. But I guess I would say again, we're in a civilizational crisis. To think that. We don't realize how much we depend on Christianity. Our culture makes no sense without Christianity. And if the people who are trying to dispense with it succeed, and there's evidence for the fact that they are succeeding in some sense, if they succeed in eliminating Christianity, our culture will completely self-destruct. And so will our individual personal integrity. We don't realize how much our personhood, as well as our culture, is absolutely dependent on the mystery of Christianity. Even if we've never read a word of the gospel, if we live in a culture under Christian influence, we benefit from that influence. And it's up to us at this point to remind ourselves and to remind our fellows that we must revive that reality and learn once again how to learn from our Christian heritage, how to live and how to live our vocations out.
Very good. Gil, I can't thank you much. Can't thank you enough for spending the whole hour. Bill, thanks for joining us here in South Philly, where we broadcast today. Michael, over at WTMR, thanks for getting our voices out. If you missed any part of the show, we'll get the recording up in the next couple of days. Thanks again, Gil.
Thanks.
To all my listeners.
Thank you so much. God bless.
Thank you. And look forward to being with you again next Wednesday. Till then, take care and God bless.
Alrighty.